particular title to it. This is the title to the scroll. Long title, very specific. Southern School, Sudden Doctrine, Supreme Mahayana Great Perfection of Wisdom. The Platform Sutra, the Tang Ching. Preached by the 6th Patriarch Hui Neg at the Ta Fan Temple in Shaozhou, One Roll. Recorded by the spreader of the Dharma, the disciple Fa Hai, who at the same time received the precepts of formlessness. The quality of Hui Neg comes through immediately, because at the very beginning of the sutra, and this is the only work in the Chinese language that is given the title sutra. It's the only work outside of the Sanskrit language school that merited the title sutra. And the reason that it was given the term sutra is that it was as if the Buddha was talking. That is to say, the mind of Hui Neg in delivering this was no different from the Buddha speaking in Sravasti 1,000 some years before. It was the very same mind. He wasn't a second Buddha. He wasn't a third Buddha. He wasn't the 6th patriarch so much. But it was that mind, that discourse, which mysteriously was that person talking. It's not like Hui Neg is channeling the Buddha, but it's that qualityless essence was exactly what it was when the Buddha spoke. So, at the very beginning, Hui Neg says, good friends, purify your minds and concentrate on the Dharma of the Great Perfection of Wisdom. And then the man who's writing this down says, the master then stopped speaking and quieted his own mind in front of this congregation of people. Then after a good while, he said, good friends, listen quietly. And so you can see that he is preparing, did prepare. Not only just preparing the audience like a good speaker would prepare an audience, but he prepared that deep, high Dharma, conditionless context. And so the whole sutra takes place. The whole sutra itself is a massive pattern of epiclesis laid into that preparedness. When we come back from the break, we'll see how radical this was. This was extraordinarily radical. All of the traditions up to this time were that there were lineages of truth passed on, and that the most supreme lineage of truth was the mind seal from the Buddha right up to the present day. That it was passed from individual to individual, like lighting a candle from another candle, and that this flame had never gone out. And what Hui Neg will do is he will blow out the flame, and he will say, anyone who ever wants to light his candle from this can do this, even though there is no flame here. And that the truth of the High Dharma is that you will be able to light your candle from this, however long thousands of years away from me you are. And this will be the proof to you, the certainty to you, that this is true, because you will have been able to do it. No, we'll take a break and I'll come back. I'm not sure just what the dates are, but we have, I have lectured on Hui Neg here at least 4 times from this podium over the last 8 years or so, and those cassettes are available. That is to say, I'm not only presenting to you something for tonight, but I've been building for a long time on a pattern. And so I have to keep the pattern growing. So there are a lot of aspects which, if you're just coming for the first time or the 10th time or something, you're only seeing a little bit of what's going on. And the reason that I'm doing this is that no one else is going to do this, apparently. I waited for a long time for someone else to do it, and no one's done it, so you get to where you say, well, I better do it. And and what's happening here is that we're trying to recount all of the quality material which human beings have developed for themselves, so that when we leave this planet, we can leave this planet with some elegance and grace and participate in this universe instead of being hokey little planetary being. And so we have to do this now, because the people being born now are going to have to do this. So there are a lot of these qualities that have to be here. One of the qualities that Huineng set the tone for, which had not been even discussed since the Buddha, except on one occasion, was, do you have to be a monk to be enlightened? And Huineng's unequivocal answer was, no, you don't, because the Buddha's unequivocal answer was, you don't. And the only place in between the Buddha and Huineng where this issue was raised was in the Vimalakirti Sutra. And if you remember, the protagonist in the Vimalakirti Sutra was a layman who confounded not only the monks, but all of the wise bodhisattvas even, so that only the bodhisattva of wisdom, Manjushri, even had the wherewithal to come and chat with Vimalakirti. This is how Huineng says it in the 36th chapter of the Platform Sutra. Characteristic Huineng. Good friends, if you wish to practice, it is all right to do so as laymen. Just a phrase like that. Occasionally, because these are high Dharma teachings, these are not for everybody. They're not for the common, run-of-the-mill level of life. They're high Dharma. They're for those who are not only intelligent, but those who have a kind of spiritual courage which has lifted them out of the ordinary into the extraordinary. And so very often on that high Dharma level, these kinds of concerns are not talked about, because these are the concerns that you should have dealt with way back when and long since. But occasionally, they'll slip in a statement like this. It's like in the Sunday lecture I'm going to do here on the Epistle of the Hebrews in the New Testament, which is a high Dharma from Christian Alexandria, and he says at the end of the declamation, he puts a few homilies in, and he says the marriage bed is not to be scoffed at, that it is pure. Don't worry about having to be ascetic to the point of worrying whether or not you can be married. That on this level of truth, those are not issues. No one is going to pry you loose from your human life, your humanity, but this is to raise the resonance of your humanity to its apex. This is to bring the heat of your life, the light of your life, to flame. And so the master here says, good friends, if you wish to practice, it is all right to do so as laymen. You don't have to be in a temple, he says. And I wanted to get that in because I think it's important in this age where somehow we think that the masters of Asian wisdom all have to be monks. They all have to have robes. I was at a confab one time, I guess it was about 6-7 years ago, where the Venerable Wapol Rahula a monk from Sri Lanka who was just coming back from Oxford University, coming through Los Angeles, and he spoke, and there arrayed were all the different monks and priests of all the different Buddhist sects, and they had all their different robes on, saffron or black or brown or red or gray or whatever it was. And he, looking for all the world like Barry Fitzgerald with his grin, the old movie actor, first thing he said is that the Dharma has no robes. And that maybe in the West, Buddhism will not need robes at all, of any color. And he sort of looked around and then he let it go at that. I was incidentally the only person in the room without a robe on. You don't need robes and you don't... The whole issue in the Platform Sutra, he talks about how he was given the robe by the great master, Hung Jin. And Hung Jin was the fifth patriarch. And Huineng recounts how he was selling firewood. His father had died, and he was supporting his mother by selling firewood. And in the city in southern China, where he was selling firewood, he heard someone chanting. And the verses happened to be from the Diamond Sutra. And when he heard them, he could hear them. He understood. And so he asked the person, what is that that you're saying? And then, of course, you know, where did you get that? Who talks about these things? And then he went there, and of course, because he was an ignorant, illiterate, southern Chinese boy, they put him in the kitchen to, you know, work over the rice, to get the hulls off the rice, and to wash the pots and pans. And he spent 8 months in the kitchen. And the old master was trying to pass the robe on, the robe and the bowl, as symbols of mastery. And he was unable to do this, and so he wanted to have everybody in the monastery, there were some 500 monks there, write a verse expressing their experience of enlightenment to see who had the highest understanding, and to him he would pass on the robe. Now, of course, the head teacher, the head professor, the head monk, Chen Hui, was the only one who actually did write a verse. Everyone else was kind of expecting, well, he's the head professor, he'll be the one. And he put his verse up, and everybody applauded that, because the master said, well, this is very good. But then privately he told Chen Hui that this isn't really quite it. Can't you think about this and go inside of this and do another one? And if you can just do that, then I'll turn the stuff over to you. And he couldn't do that. He'd reached on his tiptoes and he'd gotten to where he could. And Huineng again heard somebody chanting this verse. And he immediately heard that this person was, as they say, standing at the doorway but hadn't gone in. And so Huineng chanted back a verse, and this person was kind of surprised at this, and because he couldn't read or write, that person then wrote Huineng's verse on the wall. And the master, around midnight, called Huineng in and said, you're the one, and gave him the robe. And then he said, you better leave, because everybody's going to be after your hide. And they were. Huineng says several hundred people tried to kill him because he had the thing of power. And he never passed on the robe because he told his people there is no more robe. There is going to be no more lineage in this kind of single strand, this kind of tenuous. Because instead of just passing it on to one, I'm going to broadcast it into the whole Dharmakaya, the whole body of truth is going to resonate. I'm going to pass this on to all who will ever wish to have it. I'm going to put it into the permanent air so that anybody who ever comes into contact with it will find me there forever. This is a revolution. This is a revolution in the whole tradition, as it were. Now, some people have tried to make something out of this and say, well, all this sounds very mythic. And the truth is indeed it is mythic. And to borrow a phrase from the great photographer Edward Weston, paraphrase a little bit, myth is the strongest way of seeing history. It's a composing way. It's a creating way. It's a way to remember the essential pattern of truth. The Platform Sutra is the only thing which he wished to pass on. And in the Platform Sutra, he is broadcasting this. And so there is a kind of a ceremony of demagnetizing going on in the Platform Sutra as it moves along, stage by stage, various aspects which everybody expects are dealt with and then untied and let loose. And he goes through ritual, and he goes through myth, and he goes through symbols, and he goes through magic, and he goes through the whole realm of the psyche, untying all of the expectations, as if to say, there are going to be no more of these. That is to say, they will no longer be necessary. That up until my time, they were all necessary because everything was honed in this way. And now I'm going to untie, unhone everything. I'm going to open up the whole hourglass of possibility so that as ages go on, it will just be wider and wider and available to whomever will come in contact with it. Sudden enlightenment. One of the basic qualities that was there that had honed itself by the time of Huineng, that is to say, by about 700 AD, was the development of very powerful meditative techniques. They began to start in India around the 2nd and 3rd century AD, and by Huineng's time, the Yogacara idealism and the beginnings of the rise of Vedanta and the whole, the whole ceremonial ritual milieu of yoga techniques had become extraordinarily concentrated, sophisticated, powerful, and capable, of course, of being illusory. And illusion on that level of sophistication is very hard to penetrate indeed. And so Huineng creates a revolution here by emphasizing that one does not have to sit in meditation. That the real yoga, if you want to talk about that, is in your living. The meditation is in your living, whatever you're doing. The everyday life is the context of your work. Your meditation is in your life. And so he criticizes this and comes through. And he says that we have to not be confused about meditation. Meditation, ting. It's interesting, too, because pronounced in just the right way, the word means the pot where food is cooked. It's an odd thing because he worked in the kitchen. You don't have to focus in on this. You don't have to just take yourself out of life and then sit. Whatever you're doing in your life, that's your sitting. You have to sit into your life. You have to bring this concentration, this meditation into your life, whatever you're doing, and you'll see that it works there. And that there's a quality that emerges, that the meditation, the concentration there, will begin to have the characteristic of prajna, of wisdom. This unconscious movement, the lightning of which, the intuition of which, will begin to appear in your everyday life, that whatever you do will have that kind of a pristine quality of what we would say togetherness. We talk about in the 1980s, together, whatever you do will be all of one piece. That your life will begin to have a fabric quality. Seamless quality, that this is a real fine fabric of living. This life has an integrity. This doing of my life has a mystery built into it. The scintillation is there in the doing of it. And so he says, good friends, you must all with your own bodies receive the precepts of formlessness. And then he goes on with that. That is to say, with your own bodies. Our body in this life is that one vehicle. One doesn't need to try and arrange the mind and think now, what orientation do I have? Am I in the Hinayana? Am I in the Mahayana? Am I in the Vajrayana? Am I Taoist or am I Buddhist? Or am I this or that? That all of that is extraneous. This body in this life has a natural unity in its thusness. Its dzogchen is natural. Now the interesting quality about this rejecting of the necessity of sitting in meditation comes most poignantly because the first patriarch in China, who was the 28th patriarch in India, but the first patriarch in China, was a man who is known as Bodhidharma. Enlightenment truth is his name. And these fabulous Zen pictures of the bulging eyes and the huge eyebrows, they're all Bodhidharma. And Bodhidharma, mythically, when he came to China from India, found that no one could understand. And so he positioned himself in a cave and sat facing a blank wall and went into deep concentrated samadhi and stayed there. Mythically, he stayed there well past dinner. He stayed there for 9 years. Staring at the wall, and the bug eyes and the eyebrows are because he's looking at the blank wall. And then after a while, people in China, some people curious, what's this guy got? I don't see anything in the wall. Must be in the guy. He must be a great master. And finally, someone cut his arm off and brought his arm in to offer to Bodhidharma so that he would stop looking at the wall and teach him. And that was how the second patriarch got the Dharma seal from Bodhidharma, because he'd made that sacrifice. And what Kuinig is doing as the sixth patriarch is he's catching that whole lineage, that whole tradition, and throwing it up in the air. He's saying there is no seventh patriarch, but there are millions of seventh patriarchs, and whenever they want, because of the way that I'm doing it, I will always be there for you. He incidentally, it sounds incredible to us, and you may not believe it, I happen to believe it. When he, they used to say, was gathered in at age 76, he ossified his body. And the body is still extant in China. The skin turned to kind of a black like anthracite coal. And it was mummified just as he was in his seated position. And you say, well, I don't know, I'm stretching it. Well, in the Cambridge History of Science and Civilization in China, published by Cambridge University Press, I guess it must be 12 or 13 huge volumes, edited by Joseph Needham, who's the master of Caius College, Caius and Glanville College at Cambridge, took a photograph of the mummified body of Huineng himself in the 1930s in China and put it into Science and Civilization in China, one of the volumes. And he too said, just what I'm saying to you, you may not believe it, but I do, seeing it. It was his way of displaying the kind of power that's there for us. That all of these impossibilities are really the fiction. And that truth, in its exactness, has this capacity to be literally beyond belief, which is why belief is a good thing to begin with, is like a little teaser, but it's no thing to stay with. What you stay with is certainty and exactness. And certainty and exactness relentlessly pursue to the very experience itself, your enlightenment. And so this quality is there in the High Dharma, that no one's word is to be taken, that the proof is always, did anyone do it, and are people still able to do it this way? So that he gives a series of vows, and you can read it for yourself, and practices and so forth. And then he begins to talk about straightforward practice. Good friends, if you wish to enter the most profound Dharma realm of the Prajna Samadhi, that is the experience on the high Dharma level is always called Samadhi. That is to say, from a worldly standpoint, one talks about it as a transcendental trance state. But in a samadhi, it's anything but transcendental. In a trance state, in a samadhi, it has every characteristic of immanence. So a mystic will talk about immanence, and a rationalist will talk about transcendence. But actually, in a deepened samadhi, always there is this lack of discrimination, because the whole ordination of inner and outer, immanent and transcendence, is seen to be superfluous. The prajna samadhi deepens indefinitely. Those who have been coming, remember the diagram that we had up about the three paramitas of how dana, and patience, and morality practice together, form a very stable triad, and how patience deepens into spiritual strength, into fortitude, character, and how morality deepens into concentration, into dhyana. It's not quite meditation. Ting is meditation. Chan is concentration. Chan Buddhism, they don't call it Ting Buddhism, isn't meditation Buddhism. It's the concentration. In order to have the concentration, one also has to have the virya. One also has to have that character, the character of you in your life, to be able to do this, to see this through. It takes character. And if you have ego exceeding your character, then you're not going to be able to do it. You have to have a lot more character than ego to be able to do it. And so with the character and the concentration, one sees that wisdom doesn't grow, doesn't deepen in the same way, that it deepens beyond oneself. That the prajna samadhi deepens beyond oneself, but it has a, if we can use the mathematical phrase here, it has a recursive function that operates as compassion in our lives. Not a dreamed up kind of compassion, not a sentimental compassion, but that instantaneous sympathy which comes from seeing others as oneself. Well, that person is in the existential truth of the matter, not very much different from me at all. In terms of the biochemical genome, there might be two or three characteristics that define us. And then as that deepens, one learns that there aren't any real differentiations at all. In fact, that other person is so much you that you could have an exchange of selves with them. And that's the meaning of communion. And so in the High Dharma, there's this prajna samadhi which deepens, and finally one understands that all sentient beings are as oneself. There are no barriers at all. There are no categories. So he says here, and we're to listen to him, you see. We're learning the great master's technique. How are we going to understand it? We're going to listen to it. And he's going to lay it in. Good friends, if you wish to enter the most profound Dharma realm of the Prajna Samadhi, you must straightforwardly practice the Prajna Paramita. Straightforwardly practice. With only the one volume of the Diamond Sutra, you may see into your own natures and enter into the Prajna Samadhi. We talked last week about the Vajracchedika, the Diamond Cutter Sutra. You will surely understand that the merit of such a person is without bounds. Now the merit, which is the kum, merit. The merit is not an external addition. It's not a reward which can be measured or tallied. But merit is like an amperage of your take. Your ability to participate in this whole ecology of the real. And as you do that, your merit grows. That is, it comes from you. And because of its nature, because of its existential nature, merit can only be given. It's like water coming from a fresh spring, and the only thing you can do with it is to keep it going, to keep giving it. And so the bodhisattva action is not an ideal which the mind dreams up and then convinces itself, oh, this sounds great, I think I'll try this. It's not that at all. In fact, that would be an illusion. And if one operated on that level, you would be deluded and be considered by Huineng crazy. That's not it at all. But it's when the merit, it's when the kung wells up from that deep lightning of the unconscious moving, from that pristine oneness of all, that merit heals. That's where it comes from. And how does it heal? It brings the oneness into this multiplicity in such a way that it, as the Prajnaparamita literature says, it perfumes the world with truth. So he says, and we listen, you will surely understand that the merit of such a person is without bounds. In the sutras it is clearly praised, and there's no need for me to elaborate. It is the Dharma of the Supreme Way that is expounded for men of great wisdom and high capacities. Should a man of small capability for knowledge hear this Dharma, faith would not be produced in his mind. Why is this so? And then he goes on to specify and show how when you have a closed mind, when you have a small mind like this, contact with kum, because it has the amperage of te with it, frightens people. It's like the narrowed mind is a false view realm. And when it's narrowed like that, the energy that would normally be there in the psyche is under pressure. And so it becomes highly sensitive and doesn't want to be disturbed. And as soon as you bring Te into contact with someone like that, they neurotically turn off. They say, oh, that's crazy. I'm not going to listen to you. I'm going to go watch KCOP in the movie, man. I don't want to go and hear lectures about high dharma. It's that kind of a quality, because the narrowed mind, the small mind, experiences truth as a disturbance, really disturbance. It can't quite put its finger on it. It says, that I don't want to get into that. That's too deep. Or something like that. And so Huineg goes on, and because and you have to understand here that his quality here is as a friend. He's as a friend. He's a truth friend. He's a Dharma friend. And he's bringing through this quality of truthfulness. But he's bringing the high Dharma back around into contact so that it occurs in daily life. It occurs in exactly what you're doing. That the whole object is not to make some special provision in your life for this, but to, as it were, aerate your life so that this quality can come in and participate. And it's like that spiritual leavening will do all its work. Everything begins to change. And it's like at some point in that mix, you will understand that the tide has changed, that the whole pattern of illusion is so weakened that it never again can hold you, that the whole pattern of delusion has been seen through. It may still be there, but it's not effective anymore. But Huineg's whole doctrine is that in sudden enlightenment, if you have one moment of pure prajna samadhi introduced into a life, it will instantaneously transform the entirety of the life. Because the te of a true prajna samadhi is so powerful that even one drop of it in a life which is open to it will change it instantly. We'll bring it into, as we would say, a spiritual domain. He's asked about this. And he brings to bear a verse, a long verse. And I have to give you some of it, because this is, as he says, he's brought to the level to where he's asked, what about this, and what about this, and what about this? And the questions mount up. And so Huineg replies by likening man to a city. The physical body of man in this world is itself a city. The eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body are the gates to the city. Outside there are five gates. Inside there is the gate of consciousness. And right away, one sees in that kind of deep spiritual insight the radical genius of Huineg. Because it's like those those five gates are like that Taoist five-phase energy cycle. So you've got a Buddhist structure of a self and a Taoist structure of a process, but Huineg is bringing in the quality of consciousness as that sixth gate within. It's a gate within. It's at the center of the city. It's a gate to the significance of the city. And when that gate is gone through, one goes into the true meaning of what's happening. One isn't just in the city of man, but one understands finally because one can live it, the meaning of it all. Here's a little bit of his verse, and then I'll have to end because time is running out. Proficiency in preaching and proficiency in the mind are like the sun and empty space. Handing down the sudden teaching alone, entering into the world and destroy erroneous doctrines. Although in the teaching there is no sudden and no gradual, in delusion and awakening there is slowness and speed. In studying the teaching of the sudden doctrine, ignorant persons cannot understand completely, although explanations are made in 10,000 ways. If you combine them with the principle, they become one. Within the dark home of the passions, the sun of wisdom must at all times shine. Erroneous thoughts come because of the passions. When correct thoughts come, the passions are cast aside. Use neither the erroneous nor the correct. And with purity, then you will attain to complete nirvana. And the verse runs like that, and it's characteristic of Huineng in his radical genius. Well, we have just one more lecture in this series, and we go back to India. We go back to not quite a contemporary with Huineng. Their lives overlap somewhat. The person I'll take next week is the great poet saint Shantideva. And Shantideva is the last great Buddhist sage in India. After Shantideva, the qualities of illusions and delusions became so great in India that it was almost impossible to deal with them without radical innovation. And the innovations that came developed along the lines of tantric Buddhism. But the tantric practices themselves, because they used a radical, magical quality of the psyche, became unteachable except in very rare and exotic mode. And in consequence of that, Buddhism in India literally refined itself out of existence. And Shantideva, who we'll take next week, is the last of the recognizable Buddhist sages in India who still is able to present the high Dharma in its characteristic pristine quality. And we'll take a look at him next week.